From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. Well, Jean-Luc Godard once famously said, all you need to make a movie is a girl and a gun. With Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino throws in the Nazi High Command, Winston Churchill, Adolf Hitler, and a bunch of Nazi scalping American GIs. So I think he's expanding the formula a little bit. Quentin, first of all, welcome back. Thanks for doing this.
Good to be back.
And it really is the most mythic of all the films you've done. I mean, it takes up a huge space in the kind of your mythos. And I wondered if you realized how much space it was going to take up in your canon as you were working on it.
Mm-hmm. I guess I did. I guess that's what kind of like derailed me when I first started writing the piece, because about, you know, I started about 10 years ago in 1998, right after Jackie Brown. And like the first two chapters that they're in the movie now, that's what I wrote then. And a lot of the characters you see are there. But part of the thing, though, was it would have been my first original after Pulp. So I was understandably really precious about it. And I just had in my head to do this, like, the good and the bad and the ugly of World War II movies. And it got so huge. I had the opposite of writer's block. I couldn't shut my brain off. I couldn't stop writing. I kept coming up with a new character and a new twist, and I followed them all. And it was just so huge that, you know, it wouldn't have been a movie. It would have been a miniseries. And I had this weird thing in my brain. It was like, what? Okay, what? So I'm too big for movies? Is that my stance? Is that my aesthetic? That movies can't contain me? There's no way I can make this 3 hours because I'm just bigger than movies? But also I was having fun time just writing. So, you know, I did that for about a couple of years until I finally just realized it, you know, it wasn't going to get solved. I put it away. And then I did this little exploitation thing called Kill Bill, and that was going to tame me as far as like how I could approach my epic. Cut to Kill Bill volumes 1 and 2.
But the thing about this, I think of this as being a bigger mythos because Kill Bill was conceived for Uma. So
yeah.
There was an icon in mind for that. So
that's
you had
true,
an
yeah.
icon and an iconic role. But this is something you built from the ground up without those kinds of concerns at all. It had to take on a very different kind of life for you in that way.
Oh, well, no, that's very true. I mean, the thing about it is, in the case of Kill Bill, you know, that wouldn't be what it was without me building it around Uma. And that was completely and utterly the way to go. Like, you know, if you knew Eastwood was going to be as good in the Dollars movies, then you'd build it around him, obviously. And then there's other times where you actually write for somebody, you don't get that person. But then you go and get somebody else. It's usually not the next name on the list. It's usually a whole different idea. And then the movie has its own thing. But it has this whole different movie that you end up making, and that's exciting. But in this case, you know, as a writer, this is also genuinely really groovy, is if you write as many characters as I did in this piece, that I don't have an idea who's going to play them. You know, I have a lot of German-speaking roles in this movie, a lot of Germans. I have a lot of French in this movie, well, and a lot of Germans in particular. But like when I wrote these main characters of Shoshana, of Landa, even Brad Pitt's character, Aldo Raine, for the whole first half of the writing, I had no idea who was going to play them. And it goes for pretty much almost everybody in the movie. And in that instance, Then you are more like a novelist. You're not held back by anything the actors can or cannot do. You're not actually trying to shape it for an actor. The character is the character. And they truly become their own thing. So now you literally are trying to find actors to match that role. Like to just give you an example, in the case of the Nazi character Hans Landa, you know, because he just existed on the page, he became a linguistic genius in the course of writing the piece because he could speak – it just turned out that just every time I kept writing, he could speak every language that he needed to speak. Now, if I'm writing that for some actor, then I know that there's certain languages they can't speak and they'll have to learn it, and that becomes a thing that would maybe stop the growth of that character. But in this case, I finish writing and I go, wow – Landa is a linguistic genius. Well, I'm going to need an actor who's a linguistic genius, or he will never be what he was on the page.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Quentin Tarantino. His new film as writer-director is Inglourious Basterds. And I felt like that character was really influenced by Rules of the Game to some extent, mm-hmm. that sense of nobility. But, you know, if that guy were really a Nazi, mm-hmm. I mean, there wouldn't just be that kind of nobility of him caring over somebody as he's dying at all. That kind of nobility would be, or that kind of suavity, rather, would be mm-hmm. just completely colored by the fact that he is a Nazi.
You know, there's a lot of parallels in there as far as like the fact that he is a Nazi, but it's also coming across as something else. I mean, on the other hand, you know, he is a detective. He is a great detective. And his interrogations are also the same kind of interrogations that Sherlock Holmes would have. Also, not only is he a Nazi, he's a bureaucrat. There is an aspect of his interrogation that he's doing with Londa that's not a whole lot different than an IRS man coming over to your house and doing an audit.
You should talk about this actor because I only knew him from like a few like things, German television things I'd say.
The actor who plays Hans Landa is Christoph Waltz. He won the Best Actor Award at the Cannes Film Festival this year for my movie, yay. And I mean, well-deserved, I thought. One thing that was really cool about Christoph was, you know, he's done a few movies, but he's known mostly for television in Germany. And not even like the star of his own show, just usually like the third lead or something on a German miniseries. But one of the things that was really interesting that was great is like, look, he just, you know, I mean, I was very precious about the character of Londa because I realized upon finishing the script that, okay, not only is this one of the best characters I've ever written, it's one of the best characters I will ever write. I knew that there had to be no compromise when it came to casting Londa, to the degree that if I couldn't have found who I thought was the perfect Londa, I don't know if I even wanted to have made the movie. I probably would have just published the script because I just didn't want to compromise there. If Londa would be less than he was on the page, even if no one else would know it, I would know it, and I just wasn't interested in making that movie. And I was happy enough with the script as it was. So when I found Christoph, like, which happened like halfway through his first reading of a piece of paper of the opening scene, I knew that was Londa. I knew we had him. It was that immediate. This is the guy.
One of the things you can tell just since the few times you've seen him is that he takes an enormous amount of pleasure in language, which is the kind of actor that you basically always write for, somebody who loves language.
You need to have two things if you're going to act with me. One, you have to be intelligent, all right? Dumb people don't get my jokes, don't get my stuff, all right? It's a process of articulating text, all right, from that, an arduous task. And you have to love language. You know, you can't be afraid of the dialogue. It's got to be a bitch that you're dominating.
But you can't act it. I mean, it's got to belong to the character, which is the thing I find particularly fascinating. It's the thing that brings me back to you as a director is finding actors for whom that language is organic and not acted. Because there are big speeches in movies all the time, mm-hmm. but you feel like the movie stops and the your movies take on a whole other momentum when these people start.
Well, again, part of that, and literally theater actors have a little edge over a lot of the movie actors when it comes to this because they're not afraid of text. They look forward to it. All right. And like you said, the piece doesn't stop. No, it kicks into another gear. But just to even give that example when it comes to Christoph in this film, it is a situation where I was starting to despair before he waltzed into the room. Ha ha. All right. Because actors would come in. These really terrific German actors would come in. And obviously, they do good in German. And, you know, a lot of Germans know French. So they do the French and they could do it magnificently. And then they would do my English dialogue, which he has big speeches in English in the film. And they just couldn't pull it off. And it wasn't an issue of fluency. Part of the thing was they couldn't say my poetry. English, they could be fluent in English. We could talk for the next 6 hours and only speak English. But English was not the language for them to recite poetry in. And there is a poetry aspect to my dialogue. There is a musical aspect to my dialogue. There's a comedic rhythm to my dialogue.
I'm talking to Quentin Tarantino. His new film is Inglourious Basterds. I feel like this is the most musical of all your films just because there's almost a kind of it goes between like these sort of fugues almost to this sort of jazz feeling to it. And that's really a kind of music. I mean, when he's speaking, when Lars is speaking, it's almost hard bop. And when Aldo Rain is speaking, it's almost like kind of the folk music from the Appalachians. It's really very simple and very direct in the way those kind of lyrics would be that.
Well, I'm glad you're pointing that out, because there really is an opposite number quality to Londa the Jew Hunter and Aldo the Apache, which is a Brad Pitt character. And they both big sequences are interrogation scenes that are both set up where they know the answer to every question they ask before they answer it. And both of them engage in an act of theater constantly when it comes to what they're trying to get out of the person that they're interrogating.
But, you do that anyway. You tend to write characters. Your best characters are incredibly presentational, who have a real sense of themselves and live their lives as theater. We can go to David Carradine in Kill Bill, or Sam Jackson in Jackie Brown,
or in Pulp Fiction. His Ezekiel speech is a complete act of theater.
I mean, yeah, it's exactly it.
And even if it's just for himself.
and it's that thing where he starts where the delivery changes as his sense of awareness of the words change, which was, I thought, was one of the most sophisticated things I'd ever seen in the movie, which is that speech becoming something very different every time he says it. And by that part in the end, it's full of regret and self-awareness. And this is a movie where – and there's always somebody, for the most part, who's done in by self-awareness in your movies. And I don't want to give away what happens to here, but that fascinates me, that you so often write somebody who's doomed by that sense of knowing – who they are, or figuring out who they are. It's almost always tragic. In the midst of all this comedy, there's that kind of beat, and you can look at almost every single movie. It's Tim Roth in Reservoir Dogs. It's Sam Jackson in Pulp Fiction. It's Uma in Kill Bill. It happens in every single movie. Somebody understands who they are and what circumstances have forced them to become, and it's a horrific moment every single time.
But the thing about it, though, is usually those moments in the movies where it's like, oh, that's a eureka moment for either the character or the audience. Or, oh, wow, isn't that great the way they doubled back on something that was brought up earlier and now it's really paying off here in the third act. Those moments that work the best that way, I came across them as I got to it. And they were eureka moments. Oh, my goodness, he can bring this up. And when they work that way, it's because they're organic. I remember feeling really good about it when I was talking to Elmer Leonard once, when we were just discussing his novel Rum Punch that I did as Jackie Brown, when we're just discussing the piece itself. And there becomes the moment when Ordell, Sam Jackson's character, shoots Robert De Niro's character, Lewis. Now, I've even read the book that the switch that had those two characters, 15 years before. Not more, actually. And the thing is, one of the things Dutch said that was really cool was, he goes, I knew one of these guys was going to kill the other one, but I didn't know who and I didn't know when until it happened. And that's the way it is. You don't know until you get there. I thought at any time somewhere towards the middle, Brad's character Aldo could get killed. That was completely open. That could have totally happened. I had no, I had no guide that would stop anybody from getting killed. I wanted everyone to, it could be just like war, and a bullet could just wipe anybody out. I didn't know Londa, how long he would last. I didn't know how long anybody would last. I kind of had an idea about Shoshana, but other than Shoshana, everyone else was off the table.
We'll take a break. My guest is the poet, writer, and director, Quentin Tarantino. We're talking about his new film, Inglourious Basterds. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's a treatment. You can hear the show at kcrw.com.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. You can hear the show at KCRW.com. Excitingly talking to Quentin Tarantino. His new film is Inglourious Basterds. And this moment of awareness, that self-awareness moment we were talking before the break, it's so interesting to have something, to have these sort of big, expressive action canvases, to have that moment that's pure melodrama.
To me, the big melodramatic kind of putting my heart on my sleeve moment is the final confrontation between Frederick Zoller, the German war hero, and Shoshana in the projection booth.
But in the color schemes almost, the way it's rendered. I mean, Minnelli works in that same kind of way, where there's a visual component to the melodrama. It's not just the dialogue. It's the way colors come into play, all these things. And it's a very classicist kind of thing for you to do in film terms. And you always – people so often bring up the exploitation things. Mm-hmm. But I was struck by that in watching the movies to get ready for this, how that feels like a big, expressive, old-school 50s movie moment.
There is an aspect about this movie that is more classical than a lot of my other films before it.
Particularly when you use red in the movies, it brings to mind for me Minnelli or Circa, those
guys. Well, I love the whole IB Technicolor look. I mean, if I could have those dyes and just press a button that says 50s Technicolor, that would be the cinematographer on the movie. There's the button, boom. All right, I think that's how most directors feel. If they could just press a button that said film noir and boom, they get that look. They get the John Alton look, they would. Actually, finding it with Bob Richardson was a blast on this. But, one of the things, though, is—
Your DP, Bob Richardson.
My brilliant DP. A lot of this is about the dialogue and letting the dialogue kind of take the story, let the performances take the story, as opposed to doing 360s or like big wild, Steadicam shots or crane shots. In fact, I never used a Steadicam in this whole movie. It was like no Steadicam allowed on this film. That's just too easy. It just becomes too easy, and it's not that I was trying to duplicate the film style of that time, but it just Steadicam seemed wrong. If I was going to do something like that, use a crane.
Well, but the lack of the Steadicam gives the film weight because, sometimes Steadicam just seems so weightless.
Yeah.
And then this movie requires that kind of gravity.
I used a crane. I used tracking. If I'm going to move it around, and I didn't mind moving it around. There's all kinds of things where the camera moves around. It's just not made easy. it was difficult. We had to move walls out, all right, to move the camera around. Get rid of a ceiling. Here we go, all right. But one of the things, though, that I did start thinking about is, Bob Richardson is not into shooting television, all right? He likes it to be cinematic. And after so many days of shooting a sequence like that takes place in, the beer tavern, which is a long dialogue sequence, and there's a lot of long dialogue sequences in the film, I started feeling guilty and uncreative by the fact that like day after day after day, I'm like coming up with the same group of shots that you do when you sit around a table. Okay, a single, a two shot, an over the shoulder. I mean, it's the same coverage that you see on television. And then as I'm going through on our like third week with Bob, and I just keep coming up with the same television coverage for scenes, I go, Bob, I'm starting to feel really guilty just coming up with these same boring-ass shots, all right, all the time. He goes, well, they're not boring because the actors are filling them, and it's good. And he goes, Quentin, I'd be the first one to say stop Rob Reinering it, all right? But the thing is, it is, the play is the thing here, and that's what – that is correct and appropriate for what we're doing.
We're not talking about the bucket list. It's The Treatment. My guess is Quentin Tarantino, his new film as writer-director, is Inglourious Basterds. You're talking about theater, and this is also a film that's really theatrical that people are constantly assuming roles in it. Mm-hmm. And the one person who comes off the best – it fascinated me that this is – you talk about this theatrically, and you've been talking to me about it a while in terms of theater, but it feels theatrical, like people are putting on masks to do things.
People are always playing roles in this movie. They're adopting personas that are not themselves. I do love the idea of the unreliable narrator. I think that's very interesting. I always, that is the thing when you read a novel and it's written in the first person from a character is like, well, how reliable is this narrator? And like just for instance, there's an aspect in the film where you meet Shoshana, who's one of the lead characters in the film. You meet her at the very beginning in the opening scene, which takes place in 1941. Then the movie jumps to 1944, where like a lot of years have passed and she's managed to survive. And she now runs this movie theater. And in the film, I give you – no indication of how she survived during those years in Paris, how she ended up getting a movie theater or anything. It's like, to describe one thing, I mean, it's like a whole – she lived a whole movie in between the opening scene and the scene when you see her again in Inglourious Basterds. Now, you could say that she gives hints of how it happened, you know, that she had an aunt and an uncle and they left her the movie theater. Well, you have to remember now, the two times that she mentions that, she's talking to Nazis. So she's a Jew in hiding under a false identity. You can't trust what she tells the Nazis. Not at all. In fact, the first time that Shoshana ever says anything in the movie that you can believe is when she says to the character of Marcel, who's her projectionist, I love you and you love me and you're the only person in the world I can trust. That's the only time you know she's telling the truth. Everybody in this movie, for the most part, is a very unreliable narrator. You really cannot take anything that they say, usually depending on who they're talking to, as face value.
Except for, interestingly, you know, the one person who, the purist, in some weird way, is Aldo Raine, the American, who is exactly what he says he is. And again, even though he gets big speeches, they're mostly filled with pretty short sentences. Mm-hmm. Because again, to me, it's like the blues, almost like Hank Williams songs. I'm going to do this. Your heart's going to get broken.
Yeah.
It's this simple, but it's very direct and plain spoken in that way. And he ends up, well, I don't want to give too much away, but that purity, if you will, of his ends up leading him to be the person who comes through in the most interesting way.
You're right. Aldo is who he is all the way through. Even when he's caught, he is who he is.
And when he tries that, he's incredibly bad
at it. He's horrible at it.
I mean, he's the one person who's incapable of imposture. He can't do it. He's temperamentally not built for it.
Yeah.
And so I found that fascinating. All these people who try to change their natures are kind of done in by that. Mm-hmm. And that must have occurred to you as you were writing this version as well, because it's very different from all the other versions you've been talking about. You were going to do that. It's so much about people taking on roles and trying to figure out where they stand and trying to figure other people as they're trying to figure out their own roles in this. And that's a very different thing for you to do too.
I'm definitely getting like annoyed a little bit by when I, you know, the way some critics and some interviewers, you know, start going through a checklist of film history and just like attributing everything I do to that kind of stuff, which I think is left over a little bit from Kill Bill, but it's appropriate in Kill Bill, but it's not really necessarily appropriate on this. Having said that, one of the things that actually to me was interesting about taking on the bunch of guys on a mission genre, and it's a very subtle, it's a very subtle twist on that genre as far as this is concerned. Most people probably wouldn't get it in first viewing. But, you know, one of the things that always like struck me strange about those movies is, you know, they'll have a five-man team or whatever, and each five men are just absolutely essential to the mission going right. And so in the Guns of the Navarone, say, you know, without David Niven, there is no bomb, there is no demolition that will blow up the Guns of the Navarone. Yet no one has a problem with David Niven with his bare hands climbing a straight-faced rock to get to the Guns of the Navarone during a crazy storm. I mean, at any moment, him, Gregory Peck, they could fall to their death. In fact, you can't believe that they didn't fall to their death. And then there's no mission. And, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to climb that with, like, climbing gear on a sunny day. Forget during, you know, a storm with my bare hands. And, you know, but the thing is, well, what happens to the mission then? So I actually love the idea of setting up this whole giant thing that the only way the mission can work is with these guys. And then it all gets effed up. What do we do now?
But that's so often the thing that I always feel like when you're writing
that's,
something.
That's, to me, that's real life rearing its ugly head into genre, which is an Elmore Leonard thing.
That's definitely that. But it's also that thing that it feels to me you do that first. You always – you ask yourself that question that's at the end of the scene, that what now?
Yeah. How can I F this up for a movie? All right, but still, like, deal with it.
How can you back these people into a corner they don't expect to be in?
Exactly.
I'm talking to Quentin Tarantino. His new film is Inglourious Basterds. I think the movie sort of demanded such a wide scope, mm-hmm. or literally a wide frame, because it's really the most like proscenium arch of anything you've ever done. I mean, it really is like people making entrances coming in and out like a play. I mean, it really is like that. unlike the other movies, we basically, you know, we know who the center of that scene is going to be because mm-hmm. that person gets an entrance. In this movie, almost everybody gets an entrance.
Yeah,
it's kind of really, then that's almost part of the unreliable narrative aspect. And when Aldo gets his big entrance, in the middle of his big entrance speech, mm-hmm. he starts talking about Donnie the Bear Jew. Then we hear that bat.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just this shot of this dark cave. Mm-hmm. And so in the scene where somebody's getting an entrance, you give somebody else an entrance. So again, yeah. you're constantly doing that.
Oh, well, I mean, the thing about it, like, there's just it's just always fun when you watch another movie and watch somebody else's movie. And then, like, a character is built up. All right, and there's a big music cue or a cinematic cue or you learn information about a character before they show up. So when they show up, it's actually exciting. You know, I mean, actually, I think one of the best invisible characters that's given a buildup throughout the entire movie, even though you don't know you're supposed to pay attention to it. And then when he actually does show up, there's a giant, you know, true, like, narrator gives him an introduction is Ogie Oglethorpe, all right, in Slapshot.
Yes.
And after all these little mentions of him, you know, when the announcer guy actually, oh my goodness, this young man has had a very exciting year, you know, from his deportation from Canada, you know, and that country's refusal to accept him. You know, it's just like when he finally shows up, it's such a big deal. And it's just fun. It's movie fun when you can do that. And so, yeah, I try to do it all the time.
Well, you do. You staged it in ways to sort of keep people as kind of off guard as humanly possible.
Well, that's where you can really have fun with the whole chapter concept, you know, of a chapter structure. Because just the way they do in novels is, okay, now we're through with the Elvis character in chapter one. Now we're taking on the Quentin character in chapter two. And then it's all about them. And then eventually the characters start intertwining as the chapters go on. But that's part of the fun of a chapter structure, is you get to kind of start all over again and tell your story from beginning to end from a different area, a different dramatic idea. But now what made this different, this is a time where I actually kind of had to play by the rules when it came to the last chapter, how the movie would end. If you look at all my other movies, I guess with the exception of Kill Bill Volume 1, and even that doesn't have an ending, all right, just has a stop point.
Right.
I don't give you the big climax you think you're going to get.
This is the first thing you've ever built to a conventional climax.
I've always undercut the climax. Hopefully I didn't undercut your enjoyment. I gave you a lot of fun and you enjoyed it, but it was not the big climax you were expecting. Well, this was the one time, the one genre that, okay, if you're going to do the Guns of the Navarone, if you don't blow up the guns or come up with a real reason why you're not blowing up the guns, then you're kind of effing in the wrong way with the genre. What brought you to it in the first place? So the thing about it is I was ultimately doing an adventure movie at the end of the day, and it had to build to an exciting adventure at the end. And so it's the only time in my screenwriting career that I literally did have a master to serve eventually at the very end.
Well, I mean, it's that thing where, you know, if you make that promise, you've got to deliver on that promise or else yeah. – you're not making that film, and that was the film you wanted to make in the first place.
Yeah.
I think I know why you say we're through with the Elvis chapter now, because we're done. We're out of time. It went so quickly.
Oh,
you've got to come back.
I will.
My guest is Quentin Tarantino. Thanks again for doing this, by the way.
Good to be here, mate.
His new film, of course, is Inglourious Basterds. Our recording engineer at NPR West is Carlos Asensio. Bob Carlson is the editor. Jimmy Dempsey is the producer. I'm going to go scout some Nazis. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.